Chris Smith, in a sense, you, two questions really. One is, can you turn to Shakespeare for relevant thoughts about today's leadership? And the other is there not a quite a negative pattern across the canon of what it means to be a leader, what happens to you?
Answer to the first question, yes. Answer to the second question, up to a point, Lord Copper. Let me come to the parallel with the present day in a moment. But first of all, you're absolutely right to identify most of Shakespeare's leaders are very lonely figures. They, on the whole, are rather tragic figures. And that wonderful speech from Richard II that you quoted, it's worth quoting the bit that you didn't, which I think is in some way perhaps less well known, but even better, where he says, allowing him, that's a king, a breath, a little scene to monarchize, be feared and kill with looks, infusing him with self and vain conceit, as if this flesh which walls about our life were brass impregnable. And humoured thus, comes at the last, and with a little pin, bores through his castle wall, and farewell, king. And that idea, you're allowed a little time to monarchize. That this is all about ceremony and pomp and title. There are some, it's particularly the case in Richard II, probably the case in Henry VI and Richard III as well, that Shakespeare is sort of teasing away at this idea of the ceremony of kingship, at what value is the title and is there emptiness inside. Yeah. But then you get another kind of loneliness when you come to Henry IV and Henry V, particularly Henry V. You know that great speech the night before Agincourt, where he talks about, you know, what infinite heart's ease do kings forego. Yeah. The sense of the burdens of kingship. And there's a different kind of loneliness there. There isn't the sense in Henry V that this is a hollow bit of ceremony. In fact, there's a very complex man inside there who's struggling with the issues of leadership and kingship. But it's nonetheless, similarly, a lonely quite frightening role to perform. So I think there's a variety of different types of difficulty here. None of it's easy. And one of the absolutely key observations that comes from Shakespeare is that leadership is not easy. Mm. Now, does this have relevance to today? I think in a way it does. Firstly, when you think about the role of position and title, and it's probably more obvious in the United States than it is here. Someone becomes the president of the United States, and immediately a huge amount of respect suddenly, which may well not actually be deserved, gets actually put in place in relation to the president. It's a lonely existence, yes. Most serious political leaders will genuinely struggle with the dilemmas that they're faced with. Where I think some of them go wrong is in believing that there is an absolute priority on strength and on being seen to be strong. Our present Prime Minister has achieved a lot. He's made some big mistakes, of which the war in Iraq was the most obvious. But some of his mistakes have been driven by a perceived need to be strong. And there are times when leadership needs to be vulnerable as well. Which is why Henry V is such a fascinating character, because bound up in Henry V, there is this very complex mixture of strength and vulnerability and Henry V is not a simple character. Yeah, he's not Laurence Olivier mounting the battlements of Honfleur, nor is he a completely agonized figure not knowing what on earth to do the night before Agincourt. But those are both parts of the overall picture. Yeah. And I think the complexity of leadership is something that comes out of Shakespeare.
Okay, well, right, you're itching to say something. So, I mean, without really wanting to preface your remarks too much.
I'd like to say two things. One is, I think that the crisis is they don't know what resources to use, and that comes out really beautifully throughout Shakespeare's canon. So the Duke in Measure for Measure resorts to subterfuge, you know, and uses of magic. People resort to the uses of money. They resort to the uses of sex. They resort to the uses of what we think of as sort of corruptions of true political power. And Shakespeare constantly, in making it clear how terribly difficult it is and how almost impossible it is, he's constantly, I think, and this is sort of my thesis, holding up to us just the possibility that it could be otherwise, the possibility that it could be not corrupt, not using sex and magic and money, the three great corruptions, but it could be, so to speak, using the resources of social relationships, human society, the resources that we ought to use to get things done in our society. So that's the first thing. But secondly, what Chris was saying was just so, it just brings this key problem into focus so vividly, which is the relationship between the office and the person. And that's where it all gets muddled up. Because clearly, and I think you're absolutely right, that the US is a very vivid sort of representation of this for us, that there the idea of office really does have a resonance with ordinary citizens. The office of the president both is a material place, it's got it's a building, it's got a representation. They think of it as, so to speak, a job, which is how we think of office. But don't forget that office means duty at root. And office is the great central political resource. That's the way we can get things done, change the world, decide different ways of deciding, transform the universe and relationships within it. We could get things done that way. Usually, of course, we resort to money, magic, and personal power. It often gets corrupted. But the ideal of using the office is there. But when you inhabit an office, you're then struggling with the relationship with the body. And what we see time and again in Shakespeare's plays is the ambiguity of the body of the king and the body of the man. And, of course, we've seen this with Clinton and,
Shakespeare thrives on paradox and duality, doesn't he? And in a sense, it's extraordinary and amazing how, given how across the comedies and across all the other aspects of Shakespeare's work, theatre as a metaphor, as a way of exploring, role play as a way of exploring character, is used to the hilt. And again, in these political plays, the idea of the actor, the performer and the thing he performs, the way the mask becomes a trap, all these questions are bound into each other. Yeah. I really wanted to ask you, because Chris Smith, you did say that the office, you, describing how relevant these plays are, you talked about the office of, for example, the President of the United States. And when you said that, I did momentarily thought, well, isn't George Bush in some ways embodied the fact we're in a slightly different era, in that, in this country at least, and I know to some extent in the United States, he's constantly being pilloried as a man who's inadequate to the task and is, in a sense, has become a joke figure almost from day one. And I wanted to almost ask, how do we get from Elizabeth I, a woman who is, in some sense, invented this sort of all the trappings of power around her, became an icon of her own making. How do we get from her to David Cameron, for example, appearing on Jonathan Ross, And that being seen as somehow the true note of a good leader now, yeah. That you can go down with the kids, and you can have a chat, you can take part in a chat show, which may or may not be in any shape or form dignified. And that haven't we kind of come along quite a long way to where, in a way, there isn't kind of any deference at all.
Shakespeare was there before us. Take the progress of Prince Hal through Henry IV, Part 1 and 2. There, if you like, is your equivalent of Dave Cameron on Jonathan Ross, and Tony Blair's fallen into the same trap. Gordon Brown is in danger of falling into the same trap, and so on. These are experiences, the experience of low life, as it were, are things that you learn from. You draw knowledge and experience and ultimately some sort of wisdom from, but then you feed them into the rather more serious business of kingship.
I'm sure you've got a lot to say about King John, who's a fascinating character. Do you think it's as though Henry V, out of all the canon, he's the one who's most like a modern leader? I mean, in the sense of what he goes through, and also that aspect of blending the ordinary bloke with the great monarch.
Absolutely. There are glimpses. There's a thought occurred to me listening to Liz when she talked about the glimpses that something better, something different could happen. Mm. And you get these relatively minor but nonetheless rather important characters: Malcolm in Macbeth, Fortinbras in Hamlet, Cassio in Othello, who at the end of the play are invested with hope that they are going to take things forward to something better.
Yeah. And women who are often given a great moral voice.
Yes. Absolutely, but denied,
of course, the possibilities of true leadership.
But in terms of the central characters, Henry V has to be the one that you can say embodied here in all its complexity. Yeah. And he's not a simple character. He's not a perfect character, but embodied in there is probably more of the lessons of leadership than I think anywhere else.
Before you speak, can I just, because you've got a book called Shakespeare and Political Virtue. Yeah. Does Henry rank in some senses as the most virtuous of the kings?
Well, in fact, I'm looking not at the history plays in that book, but at the tragedies. So I can't because it's going to be a short book, right? Because it's on political virtue, which is an elusive topic. And my main focus is going to be on the way he gives us these glimpses, specifically in the tragedies. But yes, I think Henry V. Tells us a lot about the way in which the man and the office kind of wrestle with each other, and he doesn't. It's not obviously all doomed. Yeah. Although, of course, there's this tremendous moral question at the back of everything. Let's not forget with Henry V as to whether he ought to be, taking England to war and threatening
dubious ground.
Women of Harfleu with being raped if the leaders of the city don't give in. I mean, there's a kind of moral problem at the back of it.
Well, I don't know whether you want to put in a few remarks about Machiavelli, because reading some of The Prince, it did seem extraordinary that in a way there were a couple of lines from The Prince which seemed to almost encapsulate the dilemma that someone like Tony Blair is, or any leader is presented with, which in a sense it's all very well being nice, but there are times when you're going to have to play nasty. You may have to deliver, whether or not you actually carry out your threats, the other person has got, you've actually got to act, you've got to persuade people that you're a mean so-and-so. And there's just a line here where it says, he should not deviate from what is good if that is possible, but he should know how to do evil if that is necessary. Mm. And in a way that's becoming quite a remote... I mean, you can see the logic of that, but we, as you say, in the sort of post-60s culture of challenging authoritarianism, anyone who even says, "Look, I've got to play this part," is somehow down for that. How do we get to King John is a very much more medieval play, isn't it? You can't even apply that Machiavelli to that.
I think it is and isn't a medieval play. Certainly what's true, I mean, this is a very boring point, but the word leadership never appears in Shakespeare's plays. And in fact, the word leader only appears about 8 times. And that actually, it seems to me in the case of King John, that it's less about leadership crisis and more about succession anxiety, which is what a lot of these plays, particularly King John, is taken up with. You've got this aged monarch on the throne with a very, very old cabinet effectively about her. And people want to know about who is coming next. And a lot of the time, Chris was talking about Hal's loose behaviour and this Bolingbroke's censure of that as Henry IV in Henry IV Part 1 is to do with the idea that the only way he got himself to the throne was by behaving with total gravity, seriousness, and not flaunting himself in public, and has this idea that he's being punished by this son who is going to remove himself from the line of succession, that England is going to plunge into chaos again because people don't know who's next. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that in terms of King John, that's what underpins that play, that you have two strong claims to the English throne, neither of which is particularly legitimate. Mm. They're equally matched, I think it's probable to argue. And actually, it's a world within which, and again, this is very, very Elizabethan as opposed to medieval, where you believe that people can argue the case, that through the art of persuasion, if they can stand up there in front of their fellow politicians and rhetorically win the argument and carry the day, then the course of events will change. And there's something that's intrinsically Elizabethan in that, I think, certainly with the evolution of rhetoric having changed at that time. And that's what we're finding at the moment. And really, the central question of King John and why it's not done very often, I don't think, is because it doesn't have, in King John, this astonishing named part. He doesn't soliloquise. He doesn't get a proper Richard II number, although the last scene is pretty nice. And it takes a very, very clever actor, I think, to spot what there is in there in terms of a leading role. And the most interesting work we've been doing over the past few weeks in rehearsal has been testing whether or not this medieval idea of King John as a bad old king is right or not within the play. And actually there is a shocking modernity in it, because I think he is neither good nor bad. I'm prepared to put my hands up to the idea that infanticide is not a morally great plan. but there is this terrible level on which everyone is at it. And it's said within the course of the play as well. Pandulf, who's this fantastic, naughty clerical figure, this cardinal, says to the Dauphin, as he's encouraging him to try and make his own claim on England's throne, King John is finished. If he doesn't kill this kid, he'll lose the throne. If he kills this kid, he'll lose the throne. There's this sort of tragic bit at the centre of it. And so all the work we've been doing has been trying to look at his decisions moment by moment, which I suppose comes back to what I was saying about the notion of leadership, this kind of great abstract noun.
Sure.
That sits above it. It doesn't really exist. These people exist in action.
And he doesn't. There's not a moment where he reflects back in on himself about the role that he's had to play. I mean, it's unlike some of the other.
He says a messenger comes in and goes, "Listen, terrible news. The French are marching on England. Constance has topped herself, and your mother's dead." And then everyone leaves the stage. And there's this one line of soliloquy where he just goes, "My mother dead." That's it, and someone else comes on. It's sort of, that's about as much reflection as you get, really. No, because he's grasping, he's moving forwards, he's moving from crisis to crisis. I mean, in that sense, you feel like it's a very interesting view of leadership, because he doesn't get in a Machiavellian way to plan and to project, although there are people in the play who are better planners and better projectors and therefore better politicians than he is, I think.
Mm. Did you want to say anything?
Really interesting. No, I don't know whether you want to raise the issue of Machiavelli, because in a way that's going our opening, so it could bring
I'm not an expert in this area, and I gather that the word political is actually a new word at the time that Shakespeare's writing. Yeah. It's just creeping across the channel.
Yeah.
And it has quite instantly negative associations. Yeah. That it's seen as something to do with surreptitious actions by the court. I mean, so politics is seen as something in a way that the king can be in opposition to, that how much the king chooses to dabble with those schemes and those stratagems is something quite dangerous for a king. Is that right?
I think that's right. I mean, I think that the interesting thing about the term politic is that it does have a double connotation. It's instantly got the Machiavelli's old Nick connotation, which is an Elizabethan sort of idea that he represents all that is evil, and he is the guy who will say, if you really want to, you know, it's very, very funny to modern readers, if you really want to sort of poison somebody, for goodness sake, write your notes to each other in invisible ink, he says. You know, don't go leaving things lists under your pillow, because he had been arrested because a list of people, a list, you know, a list had been found under his pillow. So he was tortured.
There's a brilliant moment in King John where the guy whom John has sent away to murder the young Arthur, right, who's the other pretender to the throne, comes in and is attacked by King John for having done it. Right. He says, I can't believe you did this thing. He said, you told me to. He goes, no, I didn't. He goes, yes, this is a tragedy of kings to be understood by their signs and on the winking of authority. Right. So for someone to go and do a terrible murder, you know, right, who will rid me of this? Right. And the guy who was sent away to murder him goes, here is your hand and seal for what I did. Just go, there's a warrant. And King John goes, oh, no, now we're finished. You know, it really is. And it was, there's been an interesting moment in rehearsal trying to get across, because, of course, the Elizabethans plotted so much and wrote so much, trying to get across a great source of analogy with emails, you know, how people sort of get caught up on a string of eight emails. Yeah. It's the equivalent. Suddenly you produce a document and everything changes. So
good day to very bad news.
Yeah. That's right.
But there's another meaning of politic, which is, I think, and I'm not an etymologist, but I think it's coming into use very soon after, which is the classical sense that politics is about prudence, it's about incorporating all voices, which isn't the same as democracy, but it's about taking account of all of the sort of power structures around you, that it's about being careful, it's about thinking about the public good. And so it's an interesting term, because it's got both these very negative and these very positive connotations. And, I mean, it's just interesting that Machiavelli has come back into vogue incredibly much in this corpus of books about leadership that come out on an annual basis and in business schools, because actually Machiavelli himself is playing with the idea of prudence and publicity and the place of ethics and right and good. And it's all much more ironical. You know, he's a great ironist, and the quote, you know, the uses of sort of Machiavelli's, if you've got to be ruthless, then you'd better be really ruthless. But actually, there's an irony underlying that, which makes it a much more mixed message, because actually Machiavelli is a great Republican who thinks that you'd better, the best way of stabilising a state and transforming the lives of ordinary people is by Republican government. Self-governing institutions conducted publicly according to proper ethical standards.
And what you said just a moment ago as well, it is so absolutely relevant now, where you talk about government being about creating a consensus. Yeah. And it reflects back on that point about strength. Yeah. The notion that was prevalent in mostly American but some UK business schools until very recently, that running big organisations is about charismatic leadership from the top, where you tell people what to do. The notion that when I was in the shadow cabinet and we were preparing for government back in the mid-1990s, the idea that you should be trying to find the things that people would actually want a government to do was frowned upon. Yeah. You had to be tough. You had to be prepared to be awkward and objectionable, and that was where the premium was. Yeah. And this notion that toughness, strength, the instruction is what government is about, is absolutely fatal. Government is about building consensus.
This brings us on to actually, in a way, because we've talked a lot about, well, you know, some more of the more benevolent examples in Shakespeare. We haven't talked about some of the very bad examples, although King John obviously kind of sits on the fence, perhaps, between these two positions. But in a way, I think if you take someone like Coriolanus or Julius Caesar, and you see Shakespeare's suspicion of, well, you know, not suspicion, but he reflects the anxieties that one would have about leaders who are enthralled to the popular will. And I think it's that however much one realises that Coriolanus is a man who's deeply out of touch, refuses in an obstinate and sort of self-destructive fashion to kowtow to what the people want, there's clearly a kind of argument running through that play, which is that how far do you go? How far do you go?
There's a clear difference between governing by and leading with consent, and being populist. And there is an absolute difference between the two, but it's quite difficult to define. Looking through the Shakespeare canon, I think you can see all the various gradations of getting it right and getting it wrong.
I'm almost loath to admit this, but Shakespeare's theatre did not have directors. and on a very real level, as much as one can imagine, those plays must have been put on by consensus. And they were, when you look at the accounts of the companies, things in which lots of people, not everyone, but lots of people took a stake and a share. And it's a great truism that theatre is about collaboration, but actually it's very interesting to think of a playwright writing from his own experience and projecting forms of bad leaders who are demagogues.
How did they do it?
Well, we don't know.
They sat around in a circle and worked it out.
There's so much scholarship on this, and I'm not a great scholar, but they had to do it very, very quickly.
Sure.
So that the turnaround of plays was extremely rapid, and they think people had their own cue script parts, so that you just get your own lines and a couple of words of cue. And so I think it happened very, very fast. But certainly, the discussion about what was going to be profitable, what plays would work, what should go on next, who owned the fabric of the playhouse, which they all did jointly, who owned the props and costumes, was very much a sort of, one would like to imagine, utopian.
I want to just ask people whether they've got questions and thoughts and things like that, and I would then want to kind of circle back and ask the general question, which is about how, Christmas has very eloquently talked about how Shakespeare is, this idea of a consensual model, people who somehow are able, have got the knack of being both in charge and also able to delegate and able to refer orders up the chain rather than just down it. But we live in an age that, a country now that's extremely, extremely different to the one that Shakespeare was writing for, and where even if you look at the king model of leadership that he has in his plays, we're talking about effectively one religion country. Roughly one kind of nationality, although of course that nation sense of itself is evolving very rapidly. But we're now in a situation where we have a country that is many countries in effect. It has lots of cultures, it has lots of faiths. And I suppose the kind of question I was going to ask you to come think about and come back to at the end is in the age of the internet, of kind of plural democracies, plural cultures, where quite does the model of Shakespeare's, however complex and sophisticated Shakespeare's kings and leaders are, how does that really mesh with? I mean, should we be really looking to him for the future models of governance, or should we, in a sense, be going, let's make a break and start from scratch because we're going to need a completely different model of organising these societies that are actually very fragmented and potentially very fragmented?
The role of speech and oratory and persuasiveness it is obviously of crucial importance, and one of the difficulties of the television age is that the role of oratory in politics and public life has diminished very substantially. And that's happened even over the course of the last 20 years. It is now much more difficult to find politicians who can move hearts by what they say. Very interesting letter that Nelson wrote, which is in the National Maritime Museum now. And he was writing to a friend talking about Napoleon. And he says, the reason that Napoleon is a great general is that he says to his troops, not allez, go there. He says to his troops, allons, let us go there. And Nelson actually admired Napoleon as a general, as a leader, because he had that, and persuasiveness is part of that being at the heart of an organisation or a nation in seeking to lead it model that I was talking about earlier on, and the question about how can we actually try and teach some of this? And we try in the CLAW leadership program so far with some success, which I'm very pleased about. Business schools are beginning to wake up to it. They have changed remarkably over the course of the last 5 or 10 years, and that's very welcome. Politics probably follows a little way behind. Mm. The question about responsibility was, I absolutely agree. Mm. And being able to take responsibility and knowing that you're the guy with whom everything else stops is absolutely part of leadership. Which all sort of leads me into the question that you were asking us about. You know, this world has changed. It's modern. There are so many different faiths, so many different communities, so many different means of communication. Is Shakespeare still? Does he have something to tell us when it's all about a king and divinity and so on? Absolutely yes, because. Shakespeare is all about understanding what makes human beings tick and how they relate to each other and how they combine with each other and don't combine with each other and the roles that love and jealousy and revenge and friendship and so on all have to play, how they all intermingle, and none of that's changed over the course of the last 400 years. The gentleman at the back who said, well, you know, we've got a president and here are three things. And those three things all come out of Shakespeare because they are all about human nature and the way human beings relate to each other. And ultimately, that is what leadership's about.
Well, that's a great point, as it were, pause. And I'm sure, I'm saying we could go on all day, but we have to stop. And I hope some of these conversations, these comments have sparked thoughts and ideas in your heads, and that you'll come back to the next Broadside Brunch. I'm not quite sure what it's about. I think it's about film, but I could be wrong on that one. And thank you all very much for coming, and thank you to the panel, Lord Smith, Josie Rourke, and Liz Fraser.